From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Dr. Robert Thurman. After years of study in the Himalayas, Thurman became the first American to be ordained a Buddhist monk by the Dalai Lama. He returned to the West and founded the American Institute for Buddhist Studies. Also today, I talk with animator Steven Siegel. He's at home with the simplest pen and ink cartooning or the most advanced computer animation techniques. His Dance of the Stumblers is featured in the Computer Animation Festival. It's carnival time in Brazil, and Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad plays a couple of tunes popular during the festival. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of The Shadow of the Thin Man. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Yesterday, Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet told me a Zen Buddhist light bulb joke. Now, I'll tell you the joke a little later, but in the meantime, I offer this as evidence that Buddhism has definitely had an impact on American culture. But few Americans knew anything about Buddhism in 1962, when Robert Thurman became the first American to be ordained a Tibetan monk. He's since become one of the leading American scholars of Buddhist thought. 16 years ago, he founded the American Institute for Buddhist Studies as a center for scholarship. Last year, he co-founded the Tibet House in New York to preserve Tibetan art and culture and to present it to Americans. China took over Tibet in 1950, and since then, much of Tibet's culture and religious life has been devastated. Over 6,000 temples have been destroyed, and much of the Tibetan Buddhist leadership is living in exile. Tibet has recently opened to tourists, and Thurman spent 6 weeks there last fall. I told Robert Thurman I thought the suppression of Buddhism in Tibet probably affected how he saw his role as an American scholar and practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, people do say that. They say that aren't we lucky that by this strange disaster of history that the Tibetan Buddhists were driven out of Tibet by the Chinese communists, we have gotten to meet the Dharma. And I used to also think that and sort of say, well, yeah, it was horrible, but it worked out well for me. But lately I've turned to thinking that how much nicer it would have been if I could have just walked into Tibet and met them there. In other words, it could have happened in another way. And Tibet could have opened up in a more natural and more gentle and less dreadful way, with less suffering to its own people. And still, it could have been something would have defined my studies, and I could have discovered the tradition much more in its integrity in Tibet. So I sort of don't like that rationalization anymore myself.
But I guess it's become important for you to help preserve the traditions, translate the texts, keep them alive while the leaders are dispersed.
Something like that. It started out for me as really a philosophical and religious quest, and I could have discovered it anywhere. It wasn't even really particularly religious. It was really during my sort of youth and becoming educated and looking for some sort of inner or spiritual science, finding it in the Tibetan literature and culture as preserved from India, and then really finding that as a kind of saving thing for me, this kind of knowledge. And then only later I got into being interested in it as a religion. And then only after 20 years, I can say, did I really begin to appreciate the culture and the people and the vitality and vitalness of their role as preservers of that. And sort of, in other words, I guess I got a sense of gratitude after a long period of time. And I began to realize that there was a big work to be done to try to restore the culture in its own way. You know, it wasn't just that it was something loose on the planet that's not good enough somehow. To really show appreciation for it and to really make use of it, it's important that it's put back onto its own course, you know, from this disruption that it has suffered.
You know, in the last 20 years, there's really been quite a proliferation of people practicing Buddhism in America. I mean,
true.
Buddhism has come to
true.
America. And I think there have really been pros and cons about that. The pros are kind of obvious, the exposure to Buddhist thought. I think there have been a lot of Buddhist religious people who have come to America and have somehow become very opportunistic after they've arrived and have set up little cult groups around themselves. And I think it's made some people very cynical about mm-hmm. Buddhism in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what you think about that and if you've tried to really separate yourself from that.
Right. Well, I am quite separate from it. We founded the American Institute of Buddhist Studies initially in order to which is an educational institution, not a religious one. And one of the reasons we felt the need for that is that we felt that America is a country where you have the notion of separation of church and state. And so the Buddhist knowledge and literature and civilization should have a way of being appreciated within the basic American culture without having to be located in specific religious centers. We didn't mean it as a critique of religious centers, but we just meant it as something that America in particular should require. Now, as in regard to the sort of cult business or cult issue in regard to Buddhism, I am critical of any kind of Buddhist organization that I perceive as being too authoritarian or too old-fashioned, trying to imitate social structures that were and institutional structures that were useful in Asia. I personally am, you know, well known as being quite loud in my criticism of such institutions. On the other hand, in regard to the general culture, I would have to say that no Buddhist institution has really created like a serious cult or serious damage to people, in my opinion. You know, during the time when there has been this sort of outcry against cults, it's been Jimmy Jones, you know, who came from a Christian base. It's been, you know, Jim and Tammy Baker. There have been various gurus like Rajneesh, who has nothing to do with Buddhism, who comes from a sort of general Indian base, not really any particular Indian religious branch. And the real cults, but the greatest majority of the cults have been based on Western religions. And so I think it's kind of a bum rap for people to feel that there have been these weird cults and weird gurus and they must all be Buddhists or something just because that's sort of a foreign one or they must all be Hindus because those are foreign ones.
It's pointless, absurd, and impossible to ask someone to sum up a religion and a culture in a few short words. But is there anything that you could tell us briefly that would ground us in Tibetan Buddhism and help us understand a little the difference between the Tibetan and, say, Japanese or Chinese approaches to Buddhism?
Sure, sure. I think that if you want to sum up Buddhism in a word, I think that Buddhism's basic teaching is teaching of relativity or teaching of relationship, that people are related to their environment, they're related to each other, they're related to the universe, kind of, that the universe is alive, not dead. I think that's the fundamental message of all of forms of Buddhism is something like that. And the human tendency to think of themselves as an isolated or alienated entity that is somehow apart from nature and apart from others is the cause of most human suffering, at least human-caused suffering, you know, like fighting each other or killing each other or whatever. I would say that would be the basic Buddhist teaching. And among the various forms of that teaching, the Tibetan form is characterized by preserving in its most completeness the latest form of Indian Buddhism. If you know the history very briefly, Indian Buddhism begins around 500 BC and is wiped out in India by invasions around 1000 AD, very roughly 1500 years. And it reached a form from about 500 AD to 1000 AD that was so very complicated, had a full variety of different kinds of teachings, had a huge literature. And that particular form of Indian, that most developed form of Indian Buddhism, spread mainly only really to Tibet and through Tibet to Mongolia and somewhat to North China in the recent time. And so it's sort of complete, you know, it has all aspects that you'd find in Sri Lanka or in Burma or in Thailand. It has all aspects you'd find in Japan and China. And then it has some aspects that have been lost everywhere else, particularly having to do with the tantras, you know, the esoteric aspects of Buddhism. So that's how I would characterize it.
My guest is Robert Thurman. He's one of the leading Buddhist scholars in America. He was the first American ordained a Tibetan monk, and he's the founder of the American Institute for Buddhist Studies and a professor of religion at Amherst College. Let's talk a little bit about how you became a Buddhist. Now, you went to Tibet to study Buddhism in a monastery. You went in the hopes of becoming ordained. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I had been living actually already in a monastery in New Jersey, of all places. During my first trip to India and to the east, to the Himalayas, I had been interrupted sort of in that. I had met the Tibetans there and then come back to America due to a family event. And then I met my teacher in New Jersey at a monastery and lived there for about a year. He was not in favor of ordaining me. He felt I could be a Buddhist, but I should be a layman, and it would be more appropriate for me. But I was very stubborn. I was 21, and I demanded to be ordained. So he said, well, if you want to do that, I'll take you to India, and you can ask the lamas in India. And then he took me there, and then I lived in the Himalayan region, not actually in Tibet itself, because His Holiness the Dalai Lama and most of the Tibetan monks had fled the Chinese persecution and invasion of Tibet. And instead, I lived with them in the Himalayan refugee camps where they live. And there I lived in a monastery and eventually was ordained. And by His Holiness personally, which was really a great honor after they'd spent about a year looking me over, so to speak. And but after another year or two, I did resign as a monk, and but I remained a layman. So it should be said that although I was the first ordained monk, I'm no longer a monk. I have a family and four children and so on, and have become again a layman.
A story that I love about you is that your teacher in New Jersey, who you were studying Buddhism with, mm-hmm. when you left...
Geshe Wangyal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. when you left for Tibet, he kept your Western clothes in his closet so that you'd have them when you returned.
Right.
And to me, that story means that he didn't want your pursuit of Buddhism to become some kind of costume drama.
That's right. He was he not only stored them in a closet, he had to go and fish them out of the garbage, unseen by me, who was being a fanatic and saying, I'm getting rid of these Western clothes. And he fished them out at night when I was asleep and kept them without my knowing it. And when the day when I resigned my... being a monk and gave back my robes, he said, I realized then that I didn't have any clothes to go back to New York in. So he said, here, you'll find this useful. And I was still thin enough to wear it. He gave me my suit. Yeah, he was very good. He was, you see, the Tibetans, they were following they were still at that time only 4 or 5 years out of Tibet. And in Tibet, there's so much social reinforcement and so much structure into being a monk. It's such an easy path in a way because the society reinforces it so well that they don't think that much about that as a transition. And they didn't at that time fully understand how complicated it is for a Westerner from a Protestant-oriented society to become a monk and live like that. And whereas the Geshe Wangyal had been in America already over 10 years about 10 years at that time, and he was aware of that. So this was the reason why he was more intelligent about it than I was.
Can you give us just an idea of what the daily life is like when you are in the monastery on the way to becoming ordained?
Sure. Well, you live very studiously. You rise about 4 in the morning. You do certain meditations and prayers and recitations and visualization meditations. You then, you know, you have breakfast, and you then usually go to some classes with a teacher, and you read books, memorize some passages, and then you go and have those passages analyzed, and you read the commentaries on them. Then, you know, you have to eat your main meal by midday since you don't eat afternoon. At least you don't if you're being very strict, as I was. And so around 11, you stop and get your meal of the day together and have that meal. And then after you rest for a while in the early afternoon, more meditating, studying the classes you've been to. And then you just relax in the early evening and go to bed quite early. And then again, up around 3 or 4 in the morning. It's a routine like that. And then sometimes you take retreats where for a number of months you don't go out. People bring you food. You meditate almost all the time, recite mantras and so forth. You can do that in retreats for up to 6 months. Some people up to 3 years will do it. I never did a 3-year retreat, but I did like 6 months here and there.
It strikes me that you, of all people, should really know what transfers and what doesn't transfer of Tibetan Buddhism to life in modern America, modern mm-hmm. high-tech America. Mm-hmm. Were there things that you felt that you couldn't really bring with you once you got back to America, the things that wouldn't translate from what you'd learned?
Well, there are some things. I mean, you know, Americans are not going to become Tibetans, and buttered tea is not going to translate and things like that. I think Buddhism has a great experience of translating from culture to culture. Like Christianity, Buddhism spread from India through, you know, when Christianity spread from Palestine through the Roman Empire and all up into Northern Europe and so forth, ending up in Latvia in the 13th century, its last conversion. Buddhism spread from India going the other way to China, Korea, Japan, Indonesia, Southeast Asia, always without any violence, without any war. And it adapted itself and translated itself into many different languages. The reason that it is, I think, so adaptable is that really, Buddhism is not mainly a religion, I think you have to say. Buddhism is a sort of civilization, a system of knowledge, a system of education that sometimes employs religion as one of its forms, but it isn't primarily that. Therefore, it can fit in with people without sort of disturbing their religious beliefs to some degree, although it will inevitably ameliorate or soften the fanaticness of the way people hold religious beliefs. You see, most people think of Buddhism as a religion, and they think, well, they define a religion as a belief system, And so they think, well, Buddhism is one belief system versus some other belief systems, like a belief in God or a belief in materialism, in no God, you know, atheism or something like that. But Buddhism is not a belief system, really. It is, as I say, a system of knowledge. It is a huge variety of methods of helping people to come to understand their relativity, you know, their relationship to others and to the universe.
But I guess I'm asking, is it easy to hold on to all of those insights when you're living in a place like modern America?
Absolutely. Not only easy, but it's essential to hold on to them. If you don't find out, precisely because it's insights, it's not beliefs. In other words, if it was a matter of sort of believing that there was a Tibetan god in the sky or something, that, of course, would be difficult to hold on to. But since it's not a matter of a belief like that, but it's a matter of following a commitment to restrain one's anger, following a commitment to not act as if one was the only person in the universe, following a commitment to, you know, speaking properly, to helping people, to developing more and more one's own understanding and so forth, being more sensitive to others. Since that's what it is, without that, as you know, life gets rough, you know. And so it's very, very helpful, I think, more helpful than ever in the modern America. Toynbee said recently, I don't know if you know the famous statement by Arnold Toynbee, but he made this famous statement in a speech given at Wellesley in 1972, shortly before he died, that in two or three centuries hence, historians would say of the 20th century, its major event was the Euro-American civilization's contact with Buddhism as a sort of world religious civilizational system. And he said World War I and II will not be big in the history books. That'll just be like a pattern of long period of wars. And this and that technology will not be that big. But the encounter of the Western peoples with the Buddhist civilization will be considered the major event of that century.
Listen,
and that relates to this. Yeah.
In preparation for our interview, I learned a Buddhist light bulb joke. I don't know if you've heard this one or not. tell me what you think of this. It's a Zen Buddhist light bulb joke.
Yes, sure.
Okay. How many Zen Buddhists does it take to screw in a light bulb? Two, one to screw in the light bulb and one not to screw in the light bulb. I thought that was pretty good, actually. I don't know about you.
It is pretty good. Usually it'll be the same Zen Buddhist, though, doing both. That would be better. It's both screwing it in and not screwing it in. That would be better.
In Tibetan Buddhism, are there a lot of inscrutable sayings and the equivalent of Zen koans, little inscrutable riddles to ponder for life?
Oh, sure. There's always in Tibetan Buddhism, although the koan is not used as often in Tibetan. There were some who used something like koans, but there are many, many inscrutable sayings in Buddhism. The basic inscrutable saying is that, you know, here we are, and yet, really, we're not here. I mean, it's like the light bulb thing. That's the ultimate koan. The ultimate koan is just being there, and yet not being there, really. This is the real difficulty about Buddhism. And people think it's very worrisome, but actually it's very helpful. I mean, after all, when we're there, right, if we're really there, if we only were really there, as, like, say, a materialist thinks, you know, then when someone else thinks that, and the two of them have some conflicting idea about what's going on here, there's really no way of getting out of the conflict, right? But if both are able to take their being there with a grain of salt, where you're there but you're not there, then you can kind of realize that your point of view there is not absolute, and you're not absolute. You're only sort of relatively there. Then you can sort of be there but not there, and so you realize the other one is there but not there, so you can fit your being there together in a certain way. That's the key of it. So those paradoxes, in other words, are not just there to twist the mind. They're there to temper the sense of egocentric absoluteness that we normally bring to life.
Great. Well, listen, while we contemplate that paradox, we'll take a short break.
All right.
My guest is Robert Thurman, and he's really one of the leading Buddhist scholars in America. He founded the American Institute for Buddhist Studies, and he's a professor of religion at Amherst College. We're going to talk about his recent trip to Tibet when we come back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman is my guest. Now, you went to Tibet for the first time in September of 1987. You were there for 6 weeks. Tibet has been occupied by China since around 1950, and most of the Buddhist leaders have fled to other countries. I guess recently Tibet was opened up for, for tourism mostly?
Yes, since 1979, China, with the change of guard in China, they at first said they were more or less going to get out and let Tibet fix themselves up, because especially this guy Hu Yaobang, who since has recently was removed from the Politburo, he was particularly appalled by the disaster they had wrought in Tibet, and they did that. But they didn't do that for very long, because they began to realize it would be a good tourist attraction. And so since about 1982, they began to build it up as a tourist attraction, and they've been using it in that way since then.
How much is left of the Buddhist way of life in Tibet now?
Well, very little and a great deal. Another Buddhist paradox.
Really?
Very little, in the sense that they destroyed 6,255 major monasteries and temples and left about 10. They took away everybody's rosaries. They smashed and burned millions of books and statues and melted them down for bullets, and I don't know what they didn't do. I mean, they really ravaged the entire... I mean, they actually had people take away stones from monastery walls to use to build barracks and factories. I mean, they totally wasted the place. So that means very little is left. But on the other hand, if Buddhist practice means what is in the hearts and lives of the people... It's amazing what is left there. The Tibetan people are, in some sense, untouched by 30 years of brainwashing and serious, you know, killing and serious propagandizing and class struggle meetings and I don't know what all else. And totally into it. They were astounded when they stepped back in 79 and 80 and said, okay, let's stop interfering with Tibet. Let's let Tibetans do what they want to do. To their astonishment, Tibetans walked off their various sort of productive labor posts and started rebuilding monasteries. After 30 years of being told how monasteries were a waste of time and there was nothing productive coming from monasteries, they were parasites, you know, sort of Marxist ideology, communist ideology about religion, all the Tibetans did was bring out their rosaries and start praying, going on pilgrimages, even though they were starving and poor by that time, and completely showed that their religious feeling was totally intact and absolutely undiminished. And when you go to Tibet now and you see... crowds of Tibetans come and mob you and demand pictures of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He's like more popular than the biggest rock star or movie star in Tibet. And people who've never seen him, children who've been brought up without being allowed to really learn Buddhism, somehow their spirit is more powerful than ever. I was amazed.
Did your trip to Tibet give you a different context and a different sense of the Tibetan way of life than you had by... going to the monastery in India to study Tibetan Buddhism? I mean, what did it add to your understanding of Tibetan Buddhism to actually be in Tibet?
Well, it intensified my love for it, I can say, and for the people. It didn't radically change me, any particular view I had, I would say, like sort of, you know, radically either disillusion me or inform me in a certain way. It made it all more real, what I'd been studying for 25 years. It made it all seem real, kind of. There was the actual place, and I loved the place. I just adored. I didn't really like the touring around that much because there was so much destruction. That would upset me. But just being in the country, looking at the cloud formations and at the mountains and the snow peaks and sitting on some of the sacred spots, I was just absolutely enchanted. At the same time, there was this real roller coaster, emotional roller coaster, because, you know, after an afternoon of sitting peacefully in some beautiful sacred spot and enjoying this fresh air and incredible clear light and brilliance, you'd go down through the town, you'd see these people all kind of beaten up and the buildings wrecked and this sort of tacky, you know, Chinese barracks here and there, and everybody wearing some sort of a tacky uniform with a little red star on it. It would then get very, very depressing, you know, and I was very, very upset by it on that. So it was like it was an up and down thing. What I would love to do, and I hope to do another time, is to have more time and really get off the beaten track and walk way deep into the country and spend some time in some caves and really look at that aspect, and I'm sure I'll enjoy that. Although, another thing that did amaze me, I did go a little bit, we went a little into the back area here and there, and what we found to our astonishment was that sort of Red Guard types and communist troops and things had destroyed monuments way in the most remote places where you wouldn't think anybody would bother to dynamite a big stone monument, but they did. So they left no stone unturned in their effort to wipe out that culture. But luckily they failed, since cultures are not preserved in stones primarily.
I want to ask you, you know, you mentioned earlier that you were born a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to leave the religion you were born into?
Well, I was born a Protestant, but my mother actually says that when I was baptized, I kicked over the font. But I did get drenched wet, you know. And I also drenched the priest and my mother. She remembers it vividly. So I don't know if that's a sign of a former life or something, but I was always restive in my Sunday school and in my Christian identity, naturally. I guess everyone is in our culture. You know, we're trained in science on the one hand, and we're sort of trained in the power and importance of reason and intellect. On the other hand, we're made to believe something that is said to be, in fact, not rationally believable, but we're supposed to believe it anyway. And when I was young, this bothered me a great deal, and I was very dissatisfied by it. I had a great feeling for Christ. I thought Jesus Christ, I thought he was a great fellow and a wonderful teacher and a mystic. I liked him very much. I didn't somehow like the idea of him being the only one, you know, type of thing. Or, you know, and I remember I used to put this koan, before I ever heard of Buddhism, I used to put this koan to my Sunday school teacher. I used to say, if Jesus was the Son of God, then I can't get, his suffering is not something to be taken that seriously, because after all, it was a kind of drama, you know, and as a God, he can bear such a thing. It's not like a human being bearing it. And if he was not, if he was really human, then God is quite a mean fellow, I think, I used to say. And how do you solve that type of thing? And he never really solved it to my satisfaction. So I became sort of, you know, secular and was reading, you know, Freud and Nietzsche and even Marx and all sorts of things when I was in college. And around 18 or 19, I became very interested in spiritual things through, I think, a psychology route, through Freud and Jung and Wittgenstein. And I discovered Gurdjieff, and I discovered Sufism, and I discovered Buddhism and Hinduism, and I began to feel that there was an ancient knowledge about the soul or spirit or mind that dealt with religious areas and philosophical areas that was far more advanced than what we have in the West, that our Western knowledge in that area was very underdeveloped, although, you know, just materialism and science we were good at, but we were very underdeveloped in that area. So I started looking into it. And after looking through many different systems, I discovered that Buddhism was the most extraordinary system of philosophy and psychology that the world has produced. I felt, and I still do feel that. And so I wasn't really leaving a religion for another. I was not particularly religious in regard to Christianity, and I was looking for truth as a philosopher. Subsequently, interestingly, as I grew older and studied Buddhism more and looked into its religious dimension, it made me more appreciative of Christianity's religious dimension. And nowadays I can say I truly appreciate Christianity, and I would even say that anybody who is a really good Buddhist would have to be a good Christian, and anybody who was a really good Christian would have to be a good Buddhist. There really should be no conflict between them if people really understood each other. And in fact, there is a kind of movement, a Buddhist-Christian dialogue movement nowadays, in which I'm quite active, and I see that as a very hopeful kind of movement.
Robert Thurman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Robert Thurman is the founder of the American Institute for Buddhist Studies, co-founder of the Tibet House in New York, and professor of religion at Amherst College. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, animator Steven Siegel shows you don't need a state-of-the-art computer to make state-of-the-art computer animation. His short feature Dance of the Stumblers is playing in theaters nationwide as part of the Computer Animation Festival. Also, Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad performs two songs popular during Carnival, the holiday of excess before the penance of Lent. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of The Shadow of the Thin Man. It's the latest of the Dashiell Hammett detective series to be released on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. This week's Iowa caucuses have claimed their first victim. Former Secretary of State Alexander Haig today bowed out of the race for the 1988 Republican presidential nomination. Haig finished last in the caucuses, and he is trailing badly in the opinion polls in New Hampshire. He told a news conference in Manchester today that he's thrown his support to Senate Republican leader Robert Dole.
He knows, and I agree, that in dealing with the Soviet Union, we must give Moscow no choice but restraint. And above all, it is very clear to me that Bob Dole has the strength of character a president must have.
Haig acknowledged his support was limited, but said he hoped it would make a difference. Dole has moved to within a couple of percentage points of Vice President George Bush in the opinion polls. In the Black Sea today, a naval incident involving the Soviet Union and the U.S. According to the Defense Department, two Soviet warships deliberately bumped into two U.S. Navy ships. Commander Rick Schiff said the U.S. ships were in international waters at the time.
A nation that claims a 12-mile territorial sea, or any territorial sea, must allow for innocent passage by the ships of all nations. And what our ships were doing there was exercising that right of innocent passage.
Schiff says the United States plans to protest. A court in Rome today sentenced Palestinian terrorist leader Abu Nidal to life imprisonment. He was sentenced in absentia, and it's unlikely he will ever serve his sentence. The charges stem from a December 1985 machine gun and grenade attack on the Rome airport. Abu Nidal was accused of masterminding the attack. 19 members of the French terrorist group Direct Action were sentenced today on charges of criminal conspiracy. Eight of them, including four founding members, received maximum sentences of 10 years. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The four leaders of Direct Action were taken into court today on wheelchairs. They've been on a hunger strike for 74 days. They say they're political prisoners and are trying to force France to put them in adjoining cells instead of in solitary confinement. Since 1979, Direct Action has claimed responsibility for eight murders and over 80 other attacks. The group has close links with other leftist terrorist groups in Europe, including West Germany's Red Army faction. Last year, French police effectively dismantled the group in a farmhouse raid when it arrested the four leaders sentenced today. They're soon to be tried for more serious charges, including murder. However, their lawyer says their health is deteriorating. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The trade deficit for 1987 reached more than $171 billion, a record high. But for December, the deficit fell $1 billion. It was the second straight monthly decline. And economist Barry Bosworth says overall, the trade picture is encouraging.
Probably best about it is that it's reflective of what has become a trend now. We had one very bad month back in October when the trade deficit just soared. But the general pattern during 1987 was a steady decline in the magnitude of the trade deficit, and orders data for 1988 reported by exporters looks very good for the U.S. economy.
December's improvement in the trade deficit was led by record exports totaling almost $25 billion. In other economic news today, the Labor Department reported a 0.4% increase in the producer price index last month. News of a lower U.S. trade deficit in December pushed stock prices higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 21 points to close at 1983.26. Advances led declines 7-4 on volume of 177 million shares. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Each year at this time, the entire country of Brazil breaks from regular business for Carnival, a national religious celebration which occurs before Lent. To coincide with Carnival, we've invited Orlando Haddad back for a return visit for this week's performance spot. Orlando grew up in Brazil. He now lives in Philadelphia, where he leads a Brazilian band called Minas, named after the city in Rio de Janeiro where he was born. We asked him to play a couple of tunes which have the flavor of the Carnival celebration.
The word carnaval comes from the Latin carne levare, which means to take away flesh. Since the festival happens before the period of Lent, when traditionally people should abstain from eating meat or having sex, for example, people thought, well, before Lent, let's have a blast. A lot happens during carnaval. There's a lot of music and a lot of dancing. Here is a carnaval song called Triste Madrugada, which translates Sad After Midnight. The author is singing about having lost his guitar and imagining being under his girlfriend's window singing, and she opening the window and throwing a rose at him.
Triste madrugada foi aquela eu perdi meu violão. Não fiz serenata pra ela e nem cantei uma linda canção. Triste madrugada foi aquela que eu perdi meu violão. Não fiz serenata pra ela e nem cantei uma linda canção. Uma canção para quem se ama, que sai do coração dizendo assim: abre a janela, amor, abre a janela, dê um sorriso e jogue uma flor para mim. Abre a janela, amor, abre a janela, dê um sorriso e jogue uma flor para mim. Cantando assim, la la ya, la ya, la ya, la ya, la ya, la ya, la la ya, 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 la la ya, 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 la la ya.
Here is a song that I wrote with my brother Rui during a time we were both students in Rio de Janeiro. It's called Tumrabaue, which is a word we invented. In the song, the man is asking the woman for a souvenir, which he would always remember her by.
Dá-me uma coisa, mulher. Um sorriso de fé, uma resposta de que você também quer uma boa lembrança que alegre faça bem ao coração de quem vê e ao céu de quem crê no passado e que ao lembrar primeiro faça esquecer a dor e que ao lembrar de novo faça aumentar o amor. Dar a baueira, bauar a baueira, bauar a baueira. Dar a baueira, bauar Bauera, bauá, tumra, bauera, tumbauá. Dara, bauera, bauá, rabauera, bauá, tumra, bauera,
que ao lembrar primeiro faça esquecer a dor, e que ao lembrar de novo faça aumentar o amor. Tunabauê, Tunabauê.
Orlando Haddad's Brazilian group Minas has one recording. It's titled Numja Azul. They've been back in the studio and expect to have a new record later this spring. Listening to Fresh Air. In the Computer Animation Festival, now touring the country, one short piece stands out, not for its flashy graphics or high-tech images, but for its simplicity. It's called Dance of the Stumblers, and it's created by my guest, animator Steve Siegel. Siegel's piece was done on a home computer in his bedroom. In traditional cell animation, the artist draws thousands of pictures and then photographs the pictures in sequence to create the illusion of movement. In computer animation, simply put, although the process is not very simple, the animator works with the computer to calculate objects moving through space. I asked Steve Siegel to describe his piece, Dance of the Stumblers.
It's just a little stick figures. It was intended as a parable about how stupid war starts, but it became more of a dance piece, kind of a silly dance piece. And I also wanted to see if I could produce a viable animated film on a small computer animation, without using, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar equipment.
You know, one of the things that interests me about that piece is that it's a very painterly piece in a way. I mean, you're dealing with very basic shapes, squares and diamonds and triangles, and you're using really interesting colors. It's not high-tech imagery. Were you making a statement there about how computer-generated imagery doesn't have to just be the high-tech cliches?
I guess I was. I think in my case, the statement is I just don't have very much money. But it's interesting to see painterly because I didn't think much about it, but I was somewhat influenced by Moreau and Paul Klee. And I think probably my greatest influence is the animator Norman McLaren, one of the founders of the National Film Board of Canada. And he got so much emotion and energy out of very simple shapes.
You did Dance of the Stumblers in your bedroom on a home computer. Now, why is that such a big deal?
I wrote that on the end of the piece because I had a feeling it might be shown in context with computer pieces that were done on large systems. And I think I was pretty proud of the fact that I had done it. by myself on a small computer, and the term in my bedroom is just kind of funny. I mean, it's literally true. My computer's in my bedroom. It just seemed like a funny way to say that I did this very economically.
What are some of the things that computer animation can do that more traditional forms of animation can't?
Well, I think the most widely recognized is perspective. It's very difficult to draw a complicated shape moving in perfect perspective. I think even today, Disney's using computer animation to augment their feature films. In The Great Mouse Detective, which was released a couple years ago, there's a great scene in a clock tower where these gears are turning and chains are moving around. And all those gears would be very difficult to draw in perspective. The computer could render it very easily. What would be difficult would be to make the gears have a personality.
For our listeners who haven't seen the Computer Animation Festival, what are some examples that you could give of computer animation that we'll see on TV all the time, either on commercials or in the openings to programs?
I found the one that people recognize the most is the opening to Spielberg's Amazing Stories. Even though it's not on the air anymore, it struck a chord with a lot of people. I think there was a knight swinging armor and a book flapping its pages to fly through the air. And that was a very dramatic use of computer animation that was done at Robert Abel's. And almost every opening to the movies, Saturday Night at the Movies or Tuesday, pick your day of the week, and they're, you know, pieces of film flying through space. And I know a lot of graphics for the political campaigns or the, you know, the primaries are being produced right now, so there should be a lot of that coming up on the air.
Usually when you see a corporate logo or a bottle of pills and it's spinning around
and in
three dimensions and twirling into space, that's usually computer generated, isn't it?
Yeah, what they call in the trade flying logos.
Uh-huh. Is that a big cliche now?
It is, yeah. I've heard a couple of people who work in those companies sort of look down at their shoes and say, yes, I'm a logo pilot.
Do you feel that you live in both worlds, that you'll do very commercial things to make the money back for the more experimental, personal animation that you want to do?
I think so. I mean, I've done some work on Pee-wee's Playhouse, which was a lot of fun. And that's commercial, but also I learned a lot from that experience. And then I can, you know, apply that money to work on my own films. But I've sort of made a point to try and make my films experimental but still entertaining and also a little bit different.
I want to ask you about a short animation film that you recently completed called Futuropolis. It seems
to me,
I don't
know if I'd call it short.
Well, it's long for a short and short for something feature length. It's what, 38 minutes? It's pretty long for something short, and I'm sure very, very expensive. It seems to me almost like a spoof of Japanese sci-fi movies.
Well, it's a spoof of just about everything we had ever seen. I made that film with Phil Trumbo, who's a real talented animation director.
Now, why would we know him?
He just won an Emmy for the opening credits to Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Ah.
And, we just wanted to make a spoof of science fiction. We started the film before Star Wars, and we didn't finish till after all three of the Star Wars films were done. So our production spanned 9 years. That's how long it takes to make a 40-minute film when you do it all by yourself.
The movie is about a crew of space rangers who go out into space, and out there they meet a bad guy who has a mutilation ray, and the mutilation ray can zap a person and transform them into anything from a creature to a tomato. I thought the mutilation ray was a great premise to really show off some of the computer-generated graphics that you're capable of creating.
That would have been a great use for computer animation.
That wasn't computer animation?
No. I had some computer animation that I was attempting to do in that, but I only had a Commodore 64 at the time, and it's very limited. The end credits of the film are computer animation.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it is a combination of time exposures, sequential time exposures, and hand animation, and backlit animation, and cell animation, and replacement animation. It's a catalog of animation techniques. I guess we couldn't make up our minds, so we just did everything.
Now, you started off with cell animation when you were younger, right?
Uh-huh.
So you still use those techniques, right? You haven't completely abandoned more traditional animation for computer-generated animation.
No, I haven't. I just worked on, in fact, the work I did for Pee-wee's Playhouse is hand-drawn animation. And I just did something for Kool-Aid that is hand-drawn animation. Oh, and I did some credits. I worked on some credits for a film called Earth Girls Are Easy. And it should be pretty good. It was fun working on it. I did this robot walking across, a giant robot walking down the street. So it's nice to get back and do it by hand. But I have to say, I think I prefer doing it on computer.
Why?
It's a challenge. It's very exciting. I was, some animators I know, in fact, most of the real animators that I know, like the process of drawing. I mean, they really love to draw. And I like to draw, but I really love to make things move. That is number one most important thing for me. And so the computer, once you build an object, you can then move it in any direction, and you can move the camera and change the lights. And that, I think, is very exciting. I'm working with a brand new company now. It's very exciting working with bigger computers, and it'll be real interesting to see what we can produce.
Well, Stephen, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much. It was good talking to you.
Steve Siegel's Dance of the Stumblers is featured in the Computer Animation Festival, now showing in movie theaters across the country. Here's the music from Dance of the Stumblers by Rimsky-Korsakov. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, you know, today the trade deficit figure came out. It's a little bit better for the U.S. than it was a month ago. And so we have a report about that, about how traders reacted to the news in New York, which is really more important than the news itself, it seems, at least according to an economist in Chicago we spoke to, who says this figure really doesn't indicate much of anything as to what's going to happen with the economy. Also, some reports about drugs, drug traffic in Honduras involving the military there, a virtual drug war in Washington, D.C., drug gangs in Los Angeles, and also up in Seattle.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of Hollywood's most popular movie series is now available on home video cassette, the 6 Thin Man films. Ken Tucker has this review.
The Thin Man movies, made in the 30s and 40s and starring William Powell and Myrna Loy, were innovative commercial films in their time. Director W.S. Van Dyke took the characters created by Dashiell Hammett and used them to fuse two pop genres, the murder mystery and the screwball comedy. For once, marriage was made to seem like the most exciting thing in the world. Nick and Nora Charles bantered wittily, solved crimes, and downed martinis with equal aplomb. Their dialogue was a series of fast-paced one-liners and put-downs. The solving of the murder in each film was never allowed to interrupt crowd-pleasing rituals like scenes of Nick and Nora walking their prim little wire-haired terrier, Asta. The latest release, The Shadow of the Thin Man, completes the series on video cassette. It was made in 1941, 7 years after the original Thin Man, and the strain is beginning to show a little. To liven things up, Nick and Nora were given a child, little Nicholas, but the boy isn't given much to do. In fact, that's one of the jokes. Nick and Nora are posh, on-the-town New Yorkers. They don't know anything about raising a child. So the opening scene of the movie shows Nick leading little Nicholas through the park on a leash, and the camera pans down further to reveal the boy leading Asta on his own leash. In any event, parenthood has very little to do with the main plot, which concerns a racetrack murder, as explained here to Nick and Nora by the chief of detectives.
You know that jockey Golez, the one who was caught throwing the fourth race yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
He was shot.
My, they're strict at this track.
Mm-hmm. What?
Oh, I don't think the track official shot this one. Do you, Lieutenant?
He was undoubtedly bumped off to keep him from talking.
Sounds exciting. Who did it?
Person or persons unknown did the job. And it's my job to see that they don't stay unknown. Well, so long, Nick. Goodbye, Mrs. Charles. I got to see a man about a murder.
Good luck, Lieutenant.
With luck, we ought to be out of here by the last race. Uh-oh, there go my seven winners.
Looking at the Thin Man movies these days, you realize what a yuppie symbol Nick and Nora Charles have become. The Thin Man is one main source of the rapid-fire dialogue on a TV show like Moonlighting, and on another yup hit, 30-something, the characters are always renting videos like this and yearning for the glamour of this earlier, idealized era. Other new video cassette releases include the rather amusing beach party revival Back to the Beach with Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon. Then there's Dirty Dancing, and hey, kids, what is the deal here? From the reviews I read during its theatrical release, I thought this movie had something to do with a working-class guy romancing an upper-class girl to the strains of 60s rock and roll. But I look at the video cassette, and it's just under 2 hours of leading man Patrick Swayze grinding his pelvic area into every woman he meets. In my other life, I'm a rock critic, and I'm telling you, if the dirty dancing in this movie is something you've never seen before, well, you're not out of it. I've never seen it before either. What a great hook for a movie. The filmmakers have made up an entire phenomenon that exists in a cultural vacuum. On the basis of Dirty Dancing, Swayze's being touted as a new leading man. But he rarely speaks two sentences in a row here. Who can tell how good or bad he is?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with theater impresario Joseph Papp. His New York Shakespeare Festival has staged some of the finest American productions of Shakespeare, as well as Broadway hits like A Chorus Line and Hair. His company has just started a complete cycle of Shakespeare's plays. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a reissue of the 1972 album Goin' to Kansas City by Kansas City pianist Jay McShann. And television critic David Bianculli will preview an HBO spoof of political campaigns called Tanner 88 The Dark Horse. It was written by Doonesbury cartoonist Gary Trudeau and directed by Robert Altman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.